people who are presumed to have killed him were defending their own territory.
The body of an American killed on a remote island may never be recovered. It's Monday, November 26th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Australia seeks more legal action against terrorists. Returned refugees struggle in Myanmar. People escape to prison. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Indian authorities can't say when the body of an American can be recovered from a remote 60-square-kilometer North Sentinel Island in the Indian Ocean, Andaman Archipelago, which is Indian territory. 26-year-old John Allen Cho of Washington State was killed more than a week ago in a hail of arrows after stepping ashore on the island that Indian police said is off-limits to outsiders. The island is home to dozens of Sentinelese described as a pre-Neolithic tribe. Chow, an outdoors enthusiast from southwest Washington State, is a Christian and appeared intent on sharing his faith with the inhabitants of the island. Jonah Blank is a South Asian expert and anthropologist with the RAND Corporation, currently based in Jakarta. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty, whatever his motivation, Chow's venture was illegal and dangerous.
Any contact with a remote tribe in India is illegal. It is banned for the very good reason that contacting people who are really Neolithic communities is incredibly dangerous to them in both cultural and physical terms. In cultural terms, an uncontacted people almost always finds that their civilization is wiped out culturally within a very short time of being exposed to other societies. Perhaps more importantly, at least from a universal standpoint, almost every Neolithic community that is contacted by outsiders is exposed to diseases that very often wipe them out. We've seen this in Brazil. We've seen this in islands throughout the Pacific. Just things as ordinary as measles and flu can ravage communities that have no immunity to these diseases.
Apparently he was trying to share his Christian faith, but Indian authorities are calling it an ill-advised venture.
And they're right. They're absolutely right. I, as an anthropologist, I can say that one of the cardinal rules observed by all ethical anthropologists and missionaries is not to contact uncontacted people. Any responsible evangelist knows this, because whether or not they believe that they are winning souls, they are certainly putting their prospective flock at grave risk of disease, even if you set aside cultural elements. This individual would have done a much, much better job if he had turned his evangelical attentions to the billions of people in the Western world or throughout the developed world who now profess no religious belief and might well have been more amenable to his advances.
Do you anticipate anybody will be accused of the crime?
I think it's unlikely, because the action that he was taking was illegal under Indian law and should be. The people who are presumed to have killed him were defending their own territory. They didn't know that the grave danger that he posed to them. But without knowing it, they were, in my view, committing justifiable homicide in self-defense.
The Director General of Police in Andaman and Nicobar said Chow made previous trips to the island with the help of local fishermen making contact with the tribe. On November 16th, he told them he would remain on the island. The next morning, the fishermen saw his body being dragged across the sand for burial. These are among some of the top Asian stories that you'll find right now on voanews.com. Taiwanese reject legalizing same-sex unions in referendum. Australia seeks to make stripping citizenship easier. Returning refugees face uncertainty in eastern Myanmar settlement. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. We also invite you to stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Australia is proposing new laws to make it easier to strip citizenship from convicted terrorists. Legislation is due to be introduced before the end of the year and follows a deadly Islamic State-inspired knife attack in Melbourne in early November. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Under current laws, the Australian government can only strip citizenship from people who've been sentenced to at least 6 years in prison. The measures have allowed authorities to revoke the Australian citizenship of nine individuals, but Prime Minister Scott Morrison is proposing further changes. He wants to alter the threshold for stripping Australian citizenship from those jailed for extremist activities. Morrison says people who commit terrorist crimes on Australian soil will no longer be welcome.
People who commit acts of terrorism have rejected absolutely everything that this country stands for. They've rejected the beliefs of this country, the values of this country. They have disrespected every other citizen who shares that privilege of citizenship with them. First of all, we will seek to introduce legislation before the end of 2018 to enable the minister to strip an Australian citizen of their citizenship for anyone who is convicted of a terrorism offence in Australia. There will be no condition on the length of sentence.
Under the proposed changes, the Australian government would only have to be reasonably satisfied that a convicted extremist had the citizenship of another country to fall back on. Lawyers, though, have argued the changes could see individuals refused citizenship by another country languish indefinitely in immigration detention. Ministers also want to ban people involved in terrorism overseas from returning to Australia for 2 years. It would be similar to legislation in the United Kingdom. The Morrison government is also urging the Australian Parliament's powerful Intelligence and Security Committee to finish considering new legislation that would allow law enforcement agencies to access encrypted messages. Intelligence agencies say 90 people have been charged in connection with 40 counter-terrorism investigations across Australia since September 2014. The nation's official terror threat level remains at probable.
Phil Mercer is also following Australian researchers who have made a breakthrough in the treatment of multiple sclerosis using immunotherapy. Once again from Sydney, Phil Mercer.
The Australian team says its world-first trial has produced promising results for the majority of patients enrolled, including a reduction in fatigue and improvements in mobility and vision. The treatment targets the Epstein-Barr virus in the brain that Australian researchers believe plays a role in the development of multiple sclerosis, or MS. It's a disease of the central nervous system. Immune cells extracted from patients' blood have been trained in a laboratory to recognise and destroy the virus. Professor Rajiv Khanna is from Queensland's QIMR Birkhofer Medical Research Institute.
What happens in MS, there is an immune reaction going on in your brain that is represented as if that your immune system is attacking the brain cells. Once that happens, your normal functioning of the brain gets impaired. We're trying to develop a treatment that could actually sort of make the immune system to work properly rather than going in the wrong direction.
Researchers hope the treatment could stop the progression of MS. They say the trial is significant because they've shown the technique is safe and has had positive improvements in an autoimmune disease. 7 of the 10 participants in the Queensland trial have reported positive changes, including Louise Remeswal, a mother from Queensland.
Ever since the trial, it's just improved so much that now I can go out and spend time with my family and friends.
Further research is planned in Australia and the United States. The new therapy is developed by the QIMR Birkhofer Medical Research Institute in Brisbane and the University of Queensland. The results of the clinical trial have been published in the peer-reviewed journal JCI Insight. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
In a recently built resettlement village in eastern Myanmar, returning Karen refugees struggle to adjust after more than 6 decades of conflict and displacement. Steve Sanford spoke with Karen refugees about the challenges that lie ahead for a sustainable and peaceful future.
In the new village of Lake Haw, there are clear signs that much development is still needed on the path to repatriation. But roads to the area aren't the biggest concerns, as new settlers still lack the basics.
The main problem in the village right now is the water supply. We have trouble with the water system, such as water pipes cracking or breaking down.
A mix of 3,000 Karen State refugees and internally displaced persons live in low-cost houses. But support for the 900 families with limited job opportunities is a concern for many, including former refugee Wol So.
Here it's hard to get a permanent job. The only available work is day-to-day. We have to search for our own jobs.
Many of the refugees were farmers before being displaced, and now without land, they are unemployed.
Right now, my son has a job to do, but in the past, he could not find any work. I have two more cousins that are going to resettle in this village soon, but I don't know what jobs they can find here. It's going to be hard for them.
With the ceasefire in place, land grabs are rising, and a recent study shows that military-connected businesses account for nearly 50% of them.
There are also many investors, including the Myanmar government, who want to do business in our area and open factories. They say they will create more jobs for locals, but we have to consider how to manage and make our land work for everyone.
As refugee camp budgets and food supplies shrink on the Thai side of the border, the prospect of returning to a secure and sustainable future in Myanmar remains in question. Steve Sanford for VOA News in Karen State, Myanmar.
Coming up, escaping the real world by going to prison. You're listening to VOA Asia. This news from VOA Asia, voters in Taiwan have passed a referendum asking that marriage be restricted to one man and one woman, a setback to LGBT couples hoping their island will be the first place in Asia to let same-sex couples share child custody and insurance benefits. A May 2017 constitutional court ruling was to make same-sex marriage legal within 2 years. Visit VOA Asia Facebook for more. As VOA Asia continues, for South Koreans seeking an escape from the everyday grind, a 24-hour lockup at a fake prison gives them a sense of freedom, Reuters' Grace Lee reports.
It's an unconventional means of escape, but the participants here are paying $90 a night to stay in a South Korean prison. Tucked away in the northeast corner of the country, the Prison Inside Me facility hosts stressed-out workers and students who are willing to spend 24 hours in solitary confinement.
Ironically, I feel like this prison is giving me a sense of freedom.
Here, there's a ban on any kind of communication, mobile phones, clocks, or even mirrors. And customers say the solitude allows them to get away from their busy lives. South Korea has an infamously demanding academic and work culture. According to data from the OECD, South Koreans worked over 2,000 hours in 2017, putting in the third longest hours among OECD countries. The country's suicide rate is double that of the U.S. and one of the highest in the world. The facility's co-founder, No Ji-hyung, says part of the inspiration for the mock prison came from her husband, a local prosecutor who often worked about 100 hours per week.
At first, people say it would be stuffy to be in a prison cell. But after their stay, they say this isn't a prison. The real prison is where they return to.
Since last July, the South Korean government has cut working hours to 52 in a week. But the policy has drawn criticism that says its standards are too vague.
Reuters' Grace Lee reporting. You've been listening to VOA Asia. Find us on iTunes and SoundCloud. We're also on VOA Asia Facebook, as many of you know, and on our website, voanews.com, where you can find not only today's program, but also programs past. If you happen to miss something or haven't heard the entire program, check us out at our website on our voanews.com page. You can also reach us on email. voaasia@voanews.com is a great way to contact us, as well as on Facebook. And of course, you can hear us on the radio. Falcon Radio at Adamson University in the Philippines carries our program. We thank everyone there who's tuned in today. Our thanks to go to Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Aiden Utku, Managing Editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a terrific day.